own portfolio isn't for you. When it comes right down to it, this book can't help you with a lot of the decisions you'll have to make in your investment life. I'm no expert on insurance, annuities, commodities, real estate, although selling me real estate seems to be a good strategy, rare coins, oil wells, or dog racing. I do know about special situation investing in the stock market, and I don't know of any place to get better returns, consistently and over a long period of time. That's why the vast majority of my investments are concentrated in this area. However, just because this strategy makes sense for me doesn't make it right for you. How much of your investment funds end up in these special stock situations depends on your individual financial needs, your knowledge of other investment areas, and how well you learn to apply the information in this book. While all of the market-beating strategies we've discussed can help you make or increase your fortune, some areas are easier to get started with than others. For instance, everyone can play the spin-off game. Spin-offs are easy to spot. You can pick and choose from a large number of opportunities. The bargains will keep coming, just because of the way the system works. And since the group as a whole beats the pants off the market, you can even bungle your way to some pretty nice profits. The other great thing is that you can spend your whole life just in the spin-off area. Of course, eventually no one will talk to you, and pretty soon the drool dripping off your chin can start to bug you. But there's really no need to look anywhere else. Remember, if investing in spin-offs is what works best for you, by all means, keep doing it until they cart you away. On the other hand, there are a few areas, like leaps and special situation options, where everyone, especially those just getting started with options, should use more than the usual amount of caution. While even investing a small portion of your assets in these highly leveraged instruments can lead to a spectacular increase in the worth of your entire portfolio, options carry a particularly high degree of risk. Investing in this area without a good understanding of how options work is like running through a dynamite factory with a burning match. You may live, but you're still an idiot. No matter where you choose to get started, keep in mind an entire portfolio won't materialize overnight. However, even if you only spot an attractive situation every 2 or 3 months, you should still be able to build a respectable portfolio of special investment situations within approximately a year. At that rate, over a 2-year period, you'll probably have made 8 to 10 different investments, although a lesser number are likely to be in your portfolio at any one time. Under normal circumstances, you won't end up with a portfolio of just merger securities or orphan stocks or companies going through a restructuring. If you are truly going to pick your spots, sticking to the situations that you understand well and that offer extraordinary risk-reward characteristics, 1 or 2 good opportunities from each of these areas will be a more typical experience. As I mentioned earlier, spin-offs are a different story. In recent years, there have been so many opportunities in the spin-off area that it would be possible to create an entire portfolio of just spin-offs, especially if you throw in some parent companies too. So finding 3, 4, or even 5 of these situations over a 2-year period should pose little problem. While you'll have even more opportunities to invest in leaps, since leaps are always trading on hundreds of companies, investing more than 10 or 15% of your portfolio in these instruments at any one time would, because of their leveraged nature, almost always be ill-advised. Here's another way you can play. You don't have to make up your entire portfolio out of these special corporate situations. Maybe you have another strategy that works for you. Let's say you're a Ben Graham fan. You don't want to put in the time or effort to pick individual stocks, but you still have a hankering to beat the market. Putting together a group of 15 or 20 stocks that trade at low prices relative to their book value, and also at low price cash flow ratios, will probably do the job. If you pepper this portfolio with the occasional special situation investment, accounting for maybe 20 or 30% of the total pie, you can still get very satisfying results. While I'm not a huge fan of statistical investing, because I always figure I'll do better by researching and understanding the businesses I'm buying, for do-it-yourself investors with limited time, this might be an acceptable strategy. But however it happens, let's assume you're hooked. Special situation stock investing is the thing for you. You're ready to roll up your sleeves and get to work. What do you do now? Where do you look to find these special investment opportunities? What information sources will be helpful once you find them? What if you need to brush up on the basics? Where can you get up to speed on the fundamentals of accounting? Things like balance sheets, income statements, and cash flow. Well, first, stop asking so many questions. Then, I'll be happy to make the answers to the ones you've already asked. And more, the subject of the rest of this chapter. Question. Where can you find these special investment opportunities? Answer. Read, read, read. While you might not think that a newspaper with a circulation in the millions would be a good place to hunt for bargains off the beaten path, it turns out that it is. In fact, the Wall Street Journal is the hands-down winner for best source of new investment ideas. Many big money-making opportunities, including most of the examples in this book, appear at one time or another right on the front page, sometimes for months at a time. Even though transactions and corporate changes that involve smaller companies may not make the front page, they're still in there. It's not that no one else will see this news, but after reading this book, you now have a better idea what to look for. The battle to acquire Paramount Communications made front page headlines for nearly 6 months, but the final method of payment did not. Cash, stock, and four obscure securities just don't make headlines. Although the Wall Street Journal discloses this information, they don't focus on it. You will. Likewise, while the spin-off of some small division used to be of minor concern, now it will seem like a major event. Even the word bankruptcy will have a certain cachet when you spot it in the morning paper. But you get the idea. While others will just be reading the words, you'll be finding new investment opportunities between the lines. You don't have to read anything other than the Wall Street Journal, though you can find new ideas almost anywhere in the business press. Time and interest are your only constraints. Particularly good newspapers for scouting out new ideas include the New York Times, Barron's, and Investor's Business Daily. Your local paper and regional business paper can also be good hunting grounds for special situations. This is because extraordinary transactions involving local companies and their subsidiaries are often covered locally in greater detail, with more background, and for a longer period of time than the same events in papers of a more national scope. Additionally, industry-specific newspapers like American Banker or Footwear News can be helpful. But if you don't already get one, don't bother. There's also the list of well-known business magazines to choose from. I found Forbes and Smart Money to be the best sources of good ideas. However, Business Week, Fortune, Financial World, Worth, Money, Kiplinger's Personal Finance, and Individual Investor can also be worth reading. You certainly can't and don't want to read everything, so just as you do with stocks, pick your spots. Remember, it's the quality of your ideas, not the quantity, that will result in the big money. So don't kill yourself. Read when you have time and when you're in the mood. That way, you'll end up being much more productive. If I haven't yet given you enough to read, the next source of potential ideas is investment newsletters. These are letters that come out on a periodic basis whose annual subscription prices usually run somewhere between $50 and $500. While investment newsletters generally deserve their bad reputation, I've narrowed the field down to a short list of publications that can be a particularly fertile ground for new investment ideas. My favorite, which I've already mentioned, is Outstanding Investor Digest. Phone 212-777-3330. OID interviews mostly top-notch value-oriented investment managers who discuss their best ideas in a usually cogent and understandable way. This letter is particularly good for finding potential LEAPS candidates and occasionally for learning about companies that are undergoing or have recently completed a restructuring. Another good investment letter, the turnaround letter, phone 617-573-9550, covers companies that, as the name implies, are undergoing some kind of corporate turnaround. Two of the main focuses of this letter are orphan stocks that have recently emerged from bankruptcy proceedings and stocks in restructuring mode. While this letter is a helpful source of good ideas, it should be used only as a starting point. As always, you still have to do your own work. That goes double for my next suggestion, the Dick Davis Digest, phone 954-467-8500. This is simply a selected sampling of what the newsletter's editor feels are the best ideas from a host of other stock market letters. Scanning this letter is a good way to spot an occasional special investment situation that you may have missed in your other sources. Here's another way to ferret out some new investment ideas. This one takes a phone call and a small amount of investigative work. You can get a copy of the stock portfolios of some of the best special situation and value investors in the country by simply calling. The prospectuses for the funds in one of the top mutual fund groups in the United States, the Franklin Mutual Series Funds, phone 800-448-3863, can be an excellent hunting ground for ideas. About 25% of this fund group's portfolios concentrate on companies undergoing extraordinary corporate changes. Michael Price, who manages the funds, is a well-known and outstanding value and special situation investor. Of course, you'll still have to look through a rather extensive portfolio to figure out which securities were purchased as a result of a past or pending significant corporate event. Concentrating on those special situations that are still close to Mr. Price's average cost, disclosed in the prospectus, might be a good place to start. Marty Whitman's Third Avenue Value Fund, phone 800-443-1021, provides similar opportunities for investors to pirate good ideas. Mr. Whitman is a longtime Wall Street pro who specializes in value-oriented investment situations that are unique and off the beaten path. The newest fund on the list, the Bzena Focused Value Fund, phone 800-385-7003, is run by Richard Bzena, the former director of U.S. equities at S.C. Bernstein & Co. As this fund concentrates mostly on out-of-favor large capitalization value stocks, it can be an excellent source for good LEAPS ideas. Mr. Bzena's three or four largest holdings, position size is also disclosed in the prospectus, would probably be a good place to start. Note, while I do own shares in Mr. Bzena's firm, since I'm telling you to steal his best ideas, I'm hoping any potential conflicts even out. The concept of choosing from a pre-selected list of stocks makes sense, especially when those stocks already sit in a top investor's portfolio. But remember, you only need one good idea every once in a while. It's better to do a lot of work on one idea than to do some work on a lot of ideas. Whether you go prospecting for ideas in the Wall Street Journal or in the portfolios of a mutual fund, most of the time, even after you've researched a situation, you'll still come up dry. Maybe a particular investment situation won't offer you the margin of safety you need. Maybe it won't have the upside prospects you'd like. But mostly, you'll come up dry because you don't understand the specific situation, the company's industry, the competition, or the effects of an extraordinary change. But that's okay. You're only looking for a handful of special situations that you feel confident about. So don't get overwhelmed looking for new ideas. Reading the paper every day is just fine. Now that you have a better idea what you're looking for, the ideas will come anyway. Okay, you've got an idea. Now what? Primary sources of investment information. Once you've found a potentially interesting special situation, there are a number of places you can turn to for further information. The primary source of investment information is provided by the company itself. The Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, requires that all the publicly traded companies under its supervision make certain periodic and special filings. For background information, the ones you'll be most interested in are the company's annual report, SEC Form 10-K, and the company's quarterly filings, SEC Form 10-Q. These reports provide information about the company's business and operating results, as well as the most recent income statements, balance sheets, and statements of cash flow. Also, almost anything you might want to know about executive stock ownership, stock options, and overall compensation can usually be found in the company's annual proxy statements, Schedule 14A. For extraordinary corporate events, these are the filings to look out for. Form 8K. This form is filed after a material event occurs, such as an acquisition, asset sale, bankruptcy, or change in control. Form S1, S2, S3, and S4. Forms S1 through S3 are the registration statements for companies issuing new securities. Form S4 is filed for securities being distributed through a merger or other business combination, exchange offer, recapitalization, or restructuring. This filing can sometimes be combined with a proxy statement in situations where a shareholder vote is required. S4s are usually extensive and very informative. Form 10. This is the form used to supply information on a spin-off distribution. Everything you ever wanted to know about a spin-off, but were afraid to ask. Form 13D. This is the report where owners of 5% or more of a company must disclose both their holdings and their intentions regarding their stake. If the stake is held for investment purposes, it may be helpful to examine the reputation of the investor making the filing. If the investment was made for the purpose of exerting control or influence over the subject company, this filing may be the first sign of, or serve as a catalyst to, an extraordinary corporate change. Form 13G. Institutional shareholders can file this form, in lieu of a 13D, if the investment is for investment purposes only. Schedule 14D1. This is a tender offer statement, see glossary, filed by an outside party. This document provides much useful background information on a proposed acquisition. You can usually get these from the information agent listed in the advertisement announcing the tender offer. Schedule 13E3 and 13E4. The 13E3 is the filing used for a going private transaction, such as the super right transaction in Chapter 4. The 13E4 is the tender offer statement when a company is buying back its own shares, used in the General Dynamics self-tender in Chapter 5. Remember, both of these situations can be quite lucrative, and the disclosures are even more extensive than usual, so read carefully. In many instances, you can obtain these filings for free, or for a small charge, by calling the company's investor relations department directly. All right, you might have to fib a little and say you're a shareholder. However, all of these filings are now available free of charge over the internet through the EDGAR system. Every company is now required to file its disclosure documents electronically through the EDGAR system. EDGAR is an acronym for Electronic Data Gathering Analysis and Retrieval. These filings are available through two free websites within 24 hours of their original filing with the SEC. This should be perfectly fine for almost all of your needs. Currently, New York University provides a free website at http://edgar.stern.nyu.edu, and the SEC also has a site at http://www.sec.gov. New services and information sources are being added to the online world each day. Luckily, for $49.95 per year, or $29.95 per year for print subscribers, the journal's website at www.wsj.com provides everything you need. Recent news stories can be searched for free, and for an additional per-use charge, you can search stories from thousands of publications. This site is tough to beat. One of the more affordable services for individual investors is Edgar Online. http://www.edgar-online.com/. If you simply must have those filings right away, this site can get you documents within minutes of their filing with the SEC. A basic service starts at as little as $9.95 per month. Also, Prodigy, CompuServe, and America Online have varying levels of pay-as-you-go original document services. There are also document services such as Disclosure, phone 800-874-4337, Moody's, phone 800-342-5647, Standard & Poor's, phone 212-208-8000, Federal Filings, phone 888-333-3453, Docutronix Information Services, phone 212-233-7140, and the CCH Washington Service Bureau, phone 800-955-5219, that will print and deliver these documents to your door or fax machine for a charge. Documents obtained through these high-end services can run from $15 to $35. Secondary sources of investment information. Secondary sources of information can also be quite useful to get a quick overview of a particular company or industry. I often use the well-known Value Line Investment Survey for this purpose. I don't use the service's investment rankings, but Value Line's individual company reports give a very helpful overview of a firm's historical operating and investment performance. In addition, since Value Line's reports are arranged by industry, it's very easy to obtain industry valuation data for use in valuing spin-off and restructuring candidates. With its new expanded edition, Value Line now provides helpful information on over 3,500 companies. The service might be somewhat pricey for individual investors, but most public libraries have at least one copy in their reference section. Luckily, with the growth of online and other computerized services, good investment information is more available and a lot cheaper than it used to be. If you can't get to a Value Line, you might check out the Hoover Business Resources area on America Online. Here you can find, classified by name or by industry, the financial and background information on thousands of companies. This type of information is available, in one form or another, on all the major online services. Of course, keeping up with and reviewing recent company news will also be part of your research effort. The Wall Street Journal is great, but depending upon when you spot a potential opportunity, sometimes you may need to review some past news stories. Once again, the basic online services can do the job, but a more specialized news service, Dow Jones News/Retrieval, Private Investor Edition, phone 800-522-3567, can come in pretty handy when doing background searches. Don't worry. You don't need a service this powerful to find and research one good idea every few months. But if you're really hooked on these special situations, at $29.95 per month for unlimited evening searches of the Dow Jones Newswires, the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and hundreds of other publications, it's tough to beat. Another helpful service gets delivered to your fax every morning. This one's good for both keeping you current on your positions and alerting you to new opportunities. A service called Heads Up from Individual Inc., phone 800-414-1000, can send you a brief summary of news stories affecting your areas of interest. For instance, you can get the day's top stories on topics like corporate restructuring, mergers and acquisitions, and corporate bankruptcy news. This service runs about $30 a month and is also available over the internet. But once again, you don't need any of these bells and whistles. The Wall Street Journal, a phone to call for company information and news releases, and a library card can do the trick. In most of these cases, you'll have plenty of time to do your work. If a situation is moving so fast that a couple of hours or days make a difference, it's probably not for you. Most of the Wall Street guys you see on television running around yelling and screaming aren't really thinking and doing research. They're, well, I'm not sure what they're doing, but don't you worry about it. The important thing is to stick to the few situations that you have time to research and understand. Question. What if you need some brushing up on the basics? Where can you get up to speed understanding the basic financial statements? As my father always says, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. So when it comes to reading balance sheets and income statements, if you want to look out for yourself and you're a little weak on the basics, it's probably a good idea to do a little brush-up work. Nothing major is required. You can get a good enough understanding of balance sheets and income statements from any of the following good but short primers. How to Read a Financial Report by John A. Tracy, How to Use Financial Statements by James Bandler, and How to Read Financial Statements by Donald Weiss. This pamphlet-sized book is published by the American Management Association and costs about $4. Fortunately, my favorite book in this area has just been reprinted. The book, Interpretation of Financial Statements by Benjamin Graham, is an extremely thin volume of just what you need to know. While it doesn't really matter how you learn the basics, if you can get your hands on a copy from a library or used book service, it might be worth the effort. What's all this about cash flow? What is it? Why should you care? How can you get some? Cash flow is a term investors define in many different ways. The cash flow measure that I find to be most helpful when analyzing companies is what some people refer to as free cash flow. In most cases, free cash flow gives you a better idea than net income of how much actual cash is flowing through a company's doors each year. Since cash earnings, as opposed to reported earnings, can be used to pay dividends, buy back stock, pay down debt, finance new opportunities, and make acquisitions, it's important to be aware of a company's cash-generating ability. The concept is easy enough, and you can get all of the information you need from the Statement of Cash Flows found in all of a company's required annual and quarterly financial filings. The whole idea is that the net income number, usually reported as earnings per share, only reflects a company's income for accounting purposes. Included in net income are certain non-cash expenses. On the other hand, certain cash expenses are excluded from the net income calculation. The free cash flow measure simply adds back to net income some of these non-cash expenses and deducts some of the cash expenses to give a more accurate look at how much cash a company is generating. Primarily, the non-cash expenses are depreciation and amortization. Depreciation is a non-cash accounting charge taken against earnings to allocate the cost of fixed assets, like plant and equipment, over their useful lives. For example, it's not fair to take an expense against earnings of $1 million in the year you spend $1 million on a new machine, if that machine is expected to last for 10 years. A charge against earnings of, say, $100,000 per year would be more reflective of the economic reality of the transaction. So even though $1 million in cash went out the door in the first year, the income statement only gets hit with a charge of $100,000, representing 1 year's worth of depreciation. Amortization is also a non-cash expense, similar to depreciation, except that the annual charges to earnings represent the write-down of certain intangible assets over a period of time. Intangible assets have a life of 1 year or more and lack physical substance. Goodwill is the most common form of intangible asset. It usually arises as a result of the purchase of a business for a price greater than that company's identifiable assets. This excess cost is placed on the acquirer's balance sheet as goodwill and amortized against income over a period of not more than 40 years. In many cases, as long as the earning power of the acquired business doesn't decrease over time, the amortization charge that is deducted from a company's earnings is merely an accounting fiction. That's why I'm about to add it back to net income. To calculate free cash flow in its basic form, you would 1. Start with net income, 2, add back the non-cash charges of depreciation and amortization. 3, then subtract a company's capital expenditures, which usually represent cash outlays for investments in new plant and equipment. The result is a measure of how much free cash flow a company generated that year. The calculation sounds like this. Net income, $20, plus depreciation, $6, plus amortization, $3, equals $29, minus capital expenditures, $5, equals free cash flow, $24. Notice how, in this example, the free cash flow number is 20% greater than the net income number. If, over a period of years, free cash flow were consistently higher than net income, it might be reasonable to rely on the free cash flow number rather than the net income number when figuring out the company's value, i.e., the company would be viewed in terms of a multiple to free cash flow, rather than in terms of the more commonly used multiple to earnings, or P.E. Conversely, if a company's free cash flow were consistently lower than net income, and this was not due to a big expansion which required large amounts of capital spending, it might be better to use the more conservative free cash flow number for valuation purposes. There are several reasons why a company's free cash flow may differ from its reported earnings. One reason is that depreciation, an annual charge based on the historical cost of fixed assets, might not accurately reflect the ongoing annual cost of replacing a company's plant and equipment. The cost of replacing this physical plant and equipment may have gone up each year due to inflation. Also, in some businesses, even if the current plant hasn't worn out, it may still be necessary to improve facilities constantly just to keep up with the competition. For example, a local department store or hotel may need to be renovated sooner than anticipated because of the actions of a crosstown rival or new competitor. There are also some cases where the depreciation charge is too high to accurately represent ongoing costs. Sometimes technological advances lower the costs of replacement equipment. In other instances, old equipment may last much longer than had been anticipated by the depreciation schedule. In all of these cases, examining the differences over time between annual depreciation, an accounting estimate of costs, and capital spending, the actual cash cost, can lead you to favor the free cash flow measure over earnings. Once you add back the non-cash charges for amortization, the argument for using free cash flow gets even stronger. Since in most healthy businesses, amortization is an accounting fiction, it is important to add back the annual amortization charges to get a true picture of a company's cash-generating ability. In cases where annual amortization charges are large, free cash flow is usually a far superior measure of a company's earnings power. You may recall that this was true in the case of Home Shopping Network's group of television stations, which were later spun off into Silver King Communications. One more point. If a company is growing quickly, a high level of capital spending, and therefore a depressed free cash flow number, is not necessarily bad news. That portion of capital spending used to maintain already existing facilities is the important issue. Although a few companies disclose the breakdown between maintenance capital spending and capital spending for expansion, usually you must call the company to get this information. In any event, by itself, a high capital spending number relative to depreciation is not a cause for concern, if it can be traced purely to the growth of a business that you believe will continue to be successful. Are there any other investment books worth listening to? No. Just kidding. There are no books that I would recommend that exclusively discuss the special investment situations found in this book. However, there are books that can give you excellent background information on the stock market and on value investing. All of this information can be helpful when applied to investments in the special situation area. So, if you have the time and the inclination, here is a list of my all-time favorites. David Drummond, Contrarian Investment Strategies, The Next Generation. New York, Simon & Schuster, 1988. Benjamin Graham, The Intelligent Investor, A Book of Practical Counsel, New York, HarperCollins, 1986. Robert Hagstrom, The Warren Buffett Way, Investment Strategies of the World's Greatest Investor. New York, Wiley, 1994. Robert Haugen, The New Finance, The Case Against Effective Markets. New York, Prentice Hall, 1995. Seth A. Klarman, Margin of Safety. New York, Harper Business, 1991. Peter Lynch and John Rothschild. One Up on Wall Street. New York, Simon & Schuster, 1993. And Beating the Street, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1994. Andrew Tobias, The Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need, Revised and Updated Edition. New York, Harcourt Brace, 1996. John Train, The Money Masters, New York, HarperCollins, 1994. Chapter 8. All the Funds in Getting There. One of my favorite hobbies is sailing. No racing, no destination, just being on the water and sailing. There are faster ways to move on the water. The technology has been out of date for centuries. Certainly, there are easier ways to get from one place to another. The ratio of hard work to distance traveled is great. The point, though, is not to go anywhere in particular. I always end up just where I started. The point for me is to enjoy and make the most of the journey. All the fun, as the saying goes, has to be in getting there, because there is no there. To be a successful investor over the long term, you must also pretty much enjoy the journey. Warren Buffett and Peter Lynch long ago surpassed any reasonable level of savings required to ensure that those near and dear to them would be provided for. They clearly enjoy the challenge of investing. If you're the type that's going to lose sleep after the first market dip, or worse yet, if you're going to panic out of your well-thought-out investment positions just because the market falls, then maybe a more passive approach than the one advocated in these pages would be better suited for you. In fact, if you're not going to enjoy the game, don't bother. There are far more productive uses for your time. Of course, if you are able to successfully manage your own investments, there can be some side benefits. While everyone knows what money can't buy, there are obviously things that money can buy. A sense of security, a comfortable retirement, and an ability to provide for your family. Even from a religious standpoint, money doesn't have to be such a bad thing. In fact, if it's used to help others, money can be a very positive force. Some people, include the renowned 18th century economist Adam Smith in this group, believe that when you pursue your own self-interest, the whole of society benefits. In the stock market, the buying and selling of stocks creates a market for corporate equity and ultimately provides a vehicle for productive businesses to raise capital and expand. While true, this kind of thinking can only go so far. Betting keeps the cashiers employed at the racetrack, but somehow I doubt that Albert Schweitzer pursued this particular style of altruism. There may be a higher and better use for most of your time. While to many, time is money, it's probably more universal to say that money is time. After all, time is the currency of everyone's life. When it's spent, the game is over. One of the great benefits of having money is the ability to pursue those great accomplishments that require the gifts of being and time. In fact, you can't raise a family or make your contribution to society without these gifts. So while money can't buy you happiness or even satisfaction, it might buy you something else. If viewed in the proper light, it can buy you time. The freedom to pursue the things that you enjoy and that give meaning to your life. This book was meant to be viewed on many different levels. You'll see what I mean if you take it on an elevator. If you're an investor who already has substantial stock market experience, hopefully it has opened up whole new areas of the investment world to you. In many ways, your work should be easier now that you know where to find those special places where the investment odds are so dramatically tilted in your favor. After listening to this book, you should also have a better idea what to look for once you get there. For the novice, I hope that this book has served as a first step and as an inspiration. If the opportunities described in this book sound enticing, rest assured that most of the areas covered are not beyond the grasp of the average investor. You don't have to be a genius, but you do need a basic understanding of financial statements, some common sense, and the patience necessary to gain experience. As I've said all along, it will take some work and some effort, but this knowledge should be comforting to you. If everyone could take advantage of the investment methods described in this book just by showing up, then you probably couldn't expect to achieve extraordinary results. What will set you apart from the crowd will be the same thing that will cause most investors to fall by the wayside. The barrier to stock market success isn't exceptional brain power, unparalleled business savvy, hey, I still own sea monkeys, or uncommon insight. The secret, now that you know where to look, is in simply doing a little extra work. When you think about it, this seems quite fair. While it can't be said that life is always fair, in most cases and over the long term, the stock market is. Despite being a card-carrying contrarian, I agree with the now widely accepted wisdom that for most people, stocks are the investment vehicle of choice. As long as the economy and the individual businesses that make it up continue to grow, sooner or later the stock market will reflect this reality. That doesn't mean that in every period, the stock market will provide superior investment returns. Most recently, in a stretch lasting from the late 1960s to the early 1980s, the major market averages hardly advanced at all. But in general and over the long run, the stock market will accurately reflect the progress of the businesses that it represents. Which brings us to the final benefit of the type of special situation investing that has been the subject of this book. While it's nice and often helpful to have a rising market, it's not required. Because your bargain opportunities are created by special corporate events, events that take place in all market environments. New bargains are constantly being created. In most cases, though, these bargains are only temporary. It might not be today or tomorrow, but if you do your homework well, the stock market will eventually recognize the inherent value that attracted you to the bargain opportunity in the first place. That's why, in the end, a disciplined approach to seeking out bargain stocks will pay off. The idea behind this book was to let you know about a snowball sitting on top of a hill, to provide you with a map and enough rope and climbing gear so that you can reach that snowball. Your job, should you choose to accept it, is to nudge it down the hill and make it grow. Glossary. Amortization. A non-cash charge to income intended to allocate the cost of intangible assets, assets lacking physical form, such as goodwill or patent rights, over the period of their usefulness. Although the amortization of goodwill, the amount an acquisition price exceeds the fair market value of the identifiable assets being acquired, is charged against income, this expense does not represent an ongoing cash cost. If the value of the acquired business remains stable or increases over time, adding back amortization charges to income will give a clearer picture of a company's true earning power. Listen to the cash flow discussion in Chapter 7. Beta. A stock's volatility relative to the overall market. Beta, forget about it. Black-Scholes option model. A pricing formula developed to place a fair value on options. This model, while useful under normal circumstances, virtually explodes when used to predict the option prices for companies undergoing extraordinary changes. Listen to Chapter 6 for details. Bond. A debt obligation that requires the payment of a specified sum at maturity, and that usually requires periodic interest payments. A bond may be senior or junior to other bonds issued by a corporation. It may be subordinated to other debt obligations of a company, having lower priority over a company's assets. It may be a secured bond, backed by collateral or an unsecured bond, not backed by collateral, usually referred to as a debenture. A bond can be convertible into other securities or be a zero-coupon bond, requiring only the payment of principal upon maturity. A payment-in-kind, or PIK bond, allows the issuer to make interest payments in the form of additional bonds in lieu of cash. Book value per share. The value of a company's equity is carried on its balance sheet divided by the number of shares outstanding. Book value reflects the historical value of a company's assets less all of the company's liabilities. Tangible or hard book value excludes the carrying value of a company's intangible assets, such as patents and goodwill. A strategy of buying stocks at low prices relative to their book values has been shown to consistently beat the market. Capitalization. See market capitalization. Capital spending. The purchase or improvement of fixed assets, such as plant and equipment. Capital expenditures are generally depreciated over their useful life, while repairs are expensed in the year made. Capital structure. The makeup of a company's debt and equity. A debt-to-equity ratio is one measure used to determine whether a company has a secure or risky capital structure. Cash flow. Defined in various ways. Usually, the term cash flow is used to refer to a company's cash earnings, consisting of net income plus non-cash charges, usually depreciation and amortization. Free cash flow, a more useful term because it takes into account a company's capital spending requirements, refers to net income plus depreciation and amortization less capital spending. Listen to cash flow discussion in Chapter 7. Contrarian. An investor who is willing to think and act differently from the crowd. No, it isn't. Debenture. See bond. Default. Failure to make interest or principal payments on a debt obligation as they come due. Also, default refers to the violation of certain loan covenants, e.g. failure to achieve minimum targets of earnings or assets mandated by the lending agreement or bond indenture. This is also where people from Brooklyn believe earthquakes come from. Depreciation. A non-cash charge to income intended to allocate the cost of a fixed asset, such as plant and equipment, over its useful life. Listen to cash flow discussion in Chapter 7. Efficient market theory, or random walk theory. A theory suggesting that stocks are efficiently priced and that all publicly available information and future expectations for a stock are reflected in its current price. In its strongest form, this theory proposes that a monkey throwing darts is as likely to outperform the market as a professional investor. Note, although in general the monkey thing is true, that doesn't mean markets are efficient. This theory is what they teach in business school so that you'll have less competition when doing your own stock research. Face value. The stated value of a bond, note, or mortgage as it appears on the face of the instrument or certificate. A debt instrument is usually redeemed for its face value at maturity, the time the debt falls due. A debt instrument may trade or be issued above or below its face value. Indexing, index fund. An investment strategy that seeks to emulate the returns of a particular market index by purchasing most or all of the securities in that index. An S&P 500 index fund would own the 500 stocks that make up the Standard & Poor's 500 index in the proportion used to calculate the index. This strategy is also known as giving up. Feety pajamas. Pajamas with attached foot coverings, usually worn by small children or by people who have suffered inordinate stock market losses. Fiduciary. The person or organization responsible for the proper investing of money entrusted to it for the benefit of a beneficiary, aka the one who gets sued when something goes wrong with an investment. Fiscal year. A continuous 12-month period used by a business as its accounting period. A company's fiscal year may correspond with a calendar year, ending December 31st, but many businesses have different fiscal year ends. Gilligan's Island. A situation comedy from the 1960s with Gilligan, a millionaire and his wife, a movie star, and the skipper too. Insiders. The directors, officers, and key employees of a company. This isn't the complete legal definition of insiders, but these are the guys to keep an eye on when making your investment decisions. Institutional investors. Organizations that trade large volumes of other people's money. These include pension funds, banks, mutual funds, insurance companies, college endowment funds, and union funds. Leverage. Financial leverage refers to the amount of debt a company has relative to its equity. A leveraged company will have a high debt-equity ratio. The use of financial leverage can lead to high shareholder returns if a company can earn substantially more on the borrowed money than the cost of the borrowings. A leveraged investment is one where the investor borrows money to purchase an investment, e.g. the purchase of a house with a large mortgage or the purchase of stock on margin, or where the investor buys the right to purchase at a later date a relatively large asset for a relatively small amount of money, as in the purchase of an option or warrant. Leveraged buyout. The acquisition of a company using primarily borrowed funds. The acquired company's assets and earnings power are used as the primary basis for the borrowings. You can effectively buy stock in a publicly traded leveraged buyout by investing in stub stocks, leveraged spin-offs, and an occasional merger security. Liquidity. The ability to buy and sell large volumes of a stock or other security without unduly influencing the security's price. For example, a buyer of 100,000 shares of IBM may be able to purchase those shares in line with the stock's current market price, while a buyer of 100,000 shares of XYZ Donut may force that stock's price substantially higher before finding willing sellers of that amount of stock. Margin debt. Borrowing using the value of securities as collateral. Under Regulation T, an individual can borrow up to 50% of the market value of qualified stock holdings. People who speculate in the stock market using large amounts of margin debt should refer to the definition of feedy pajamas. Margin of safety. The cushion between the price of an asset and its estimated value. Buying securities at a steep discount to their indicated or appraised value was the central investment concept outlined by Benjamin Graham. Market capitalization. Market value. The value of a corporation determined by multiplying its stock price by the number of its shares outstanding, e.g. a stock with $17 stock price and 10 million shares outstanding would have a market capitalization of $170 million. Total capitalization would equal the sum of a company's market capitalization plus the value of its outstanding debt. NASDAQ. National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. A computerized system used by brokers and dealers to provide quotations on most over-the-counter OTC stocks. Public companies must meet certain minimum requirements to be included in this system. Non-market risk. Unsystematic risk. The portion of a stock's risk that is not related to the movement of the market. If you own 5 to 8 stocks in your portfolio, in varied industries, you don't have to worry too much about this. Options. Listed options. The right to buy or sell a security at a specific price for a specified period of time. Listed stock options trade in the form of contracts. One contract represents the right to buy or sell 100 shares of stock. A call option allows the holder to call away or buy 100 shares of stock at a fixed price on or before a specified date. A put option allows the holder to put or sell 100 shares of stock at a fixed price on or before a specified date. Listen to Chapter 6 for a more comprehensive description of options. An incentive stock option differs from a listed option. The former term refers to an option granted by a company to its executives as a form of incentive payment. Preferred stock. A class of capital stock of a corporation that pays dividends at a specified rate and has preferred status over common stock in the payment of dividends and upon liquidation. A company's preferred stock obligations are junior to a company's debt obligations. Preferred stock may be cumulative. That is, any dividend payments that are missed accumulate and must be fully paid to holders of preferred shares before the common stock may receive dividends. Preferred stock may be convertible into other securities, redeemable at a specified price after a specified period of time, or exchangeable at the option of the issuing company for other securities. Price-earnings ratio, PE. The price of a stock divided by its earnings per share. This measure, sometimes referred to as a multiple of earnings, tells you at what multiple a stock is priced relative to its earnings. A stock trading at $10 per share that earns $1 is trading at a PE of 10. The reverse of the PE ratio, or the EP ratio, is known as the earnings yield. Thus, the same stock that has earnings of $1 and a price of $10 would have an earnings yield of 10%. It is sometimes easier to use the earnings yield to compare the return of a stock to that of bonds or money market instruments. Pro forma financial statement. A hypothetical example of what a balance sheet, income statement, or other financial statement would have looked like if a particular event had already taken place. For example, a pro forma income statement might show what a company's earnings would have looked like if a merger had been completed at an earlier date. Proxy statement. A document containing certain information required by the Securities and Exchange Commission to be provided to shareholders before they vote on major company matters. For example, a proxy statement is distributed to shareholders before directors are elected and before a merger is completed. Random walk theory. See efficient market theory. Risk arbitrage. The purchase of stock in a company that is subject to an announced takeover, sometimes accompanied by the sale of stock in the proposed acquirer. Why are you listening to this? I told you not to try this at home. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC filings. The disclosure forms and schedules that public companies are required to file with this government agency. These include periodic reports of financial results, as well as disclosures of material company developments. Short sale. The sale of a borrowed security with the hope that the security will decline before it has to be repurchased and returned to its owner. This can also refer to an opportunity to make a bargain purchase of pants for warm weather use. Stockbroker. A mix of a lawyer, a politician, and an insurance salesman. But I don't discriminate. Some of my best friends are stockbrokers. Stock split. A pro rata increase in the number of outstanding shares of a corporation's stock without any change in the equity or market value of the company. A 3-for-1 split of a $30 stock with 3 million shares outstanding should result in a company with 9 million shares outstanding and a $10 stock. The split by itself does not affect the market value of the company. Tender offer. A publicly advertised offer to purchase some or all of the shares of a company at a stated price. A tender offer is usually open for a limited time, and the offer to purchase shares is usually made at a premium to the company's market price. In hostile takeover situations, tender offers are often used but rarely viewed tenderly. Underwriter. An investment banking firm that sells a new issue of securities to the public. The underwriter can work alone or with an underwriting group or syndicate. In a firm commitment underwriting, the investment banker purchases the new securities from the issuing company at a discount and resells the securities at the public offering price. Village idiot. Someone who spends $24 on an investment book and thinks he can beat the market. Just kidding. Volatility. The size and frequency of price fluctuations. Although volatility is used as a measure of a stock's risk by most academics, it is generally a poor measure of long-term profitability. Warrants. A security that entitles the holder to buy stock in a company